Good morning. It's awfully nice to be with you. We'll be talking a lot in the next few days at the conference about the idea of intelligent design, the theory of intelligent design. I should let you know that not every scientist who accepts the theory of intelligent design happens to be a Christian, for the simple reason, as Dr. Patterson and I were talking before the service, that you don't have to be a Christian to see the evidence for intelligent design. Many of the hunters that he has spoken to, not godly men apparently, see the evidence because they know about animals, for example. So we'll be talking about intelligent design. I want to talk today about why intelligent design matters, however. What I should say is I am a Christian, and Dr. Patterson has therefore kindly yielded this pulpit to me for the morning. I want to talk today a bit about why intelligent design matters to Christians, in particular to people who are going into ministry and people who are concerned about our culture. I, as a fellow believer, was very moved by your singing earlier this morning and was struck by one of the songs. It reminded me of something that happened a couple years ago. I was with another scholar friend of ours who is a rhetorician of science, and we were in the South. We were in Atlanta and meeting with a med school professor who explained how he came to a belief in God because by studying the design parameters of the molecule hemoglobin in the blood. And my colleague, who is a rhetorician of science, said, "Yeah, see, I told you, there's power in the blood." So, reminded me of your song earlier a minute. Okay, so anyway, I want to talk about why this issue of intelligent design matters. And I want to start by making an observation, and that is I think that many people who have a Christian faith, if they're at all perceptive right now, have a sense that something is amiss in our culture. I sometimes like to say that people have a sense of dis-ease about our culture. That is, a vague sense that there's something wrong, but they can't put their finger on exactly what it is or where it's coming from. Another way to think of it is there is a disease in the culture, and it makes people feel dis and ill at ease. I had an experience. I was a college professor for 12 years before I left to go full-time with Discovery Institute, and I've been told I look younger than I am. I'm not sure that's true anymore, but it was certainly true when I was first a college professor. And in Spokane, Washington, where I taught at Whitworth College, there was a lot of cab drivers, a kind of eastern Washington town, and the cab drivers there listened to talk radio, and they were kind of right-wing kind of guys. Quite often. And one day I was getting a ride home from the airport in a cab, and a cab driver was talking about his frustration with all the craziness that's going on in our society, and that we kill the whales but save the babies. And then he started to rant about this court case that had just been decided, where a vicious criminal who was guilty of a murder and even, I think, acknowledged it, was being let off because of the insanity plea. And he said, "That's insane." He said, "Why do we do things like that?" Why? And I said, "I don't know." I said, "What do you think's behind that?" And he said, "Well," he says, "it's this darn permissive society of ours." And I said, "Well, why do you think we have such a permissive society?" And he says, "Well, because we don't teach right and wrong anymore." And I said, well, why don't we teach right and wrong?" And he said, he turns around, he looks at me, he says, "What are you, a college professor or something?" But I was trying to get at something. There's something deeper underneath these things that make us feel ill at ease about what's going on. And what is it? We had a similar thing as a college professor. I taught in the philosophy of science side of things, but we had a joint department with religion professors, and they agonized. These were mainly professors who were devout Christian believers. And they agonized every spring about where to send their students to seminary, because they knew that many of them would come back struggling with their faith or having lost their faith or denying the basic tenets of Christian orthodoxy. And people in the pews would say, well, how is this happening? Why are we sending people off to seminary and having them come back to be more confused than before they left and less convinced of their faith? So there's these things like this that make people feel ill at ease, but they don't know where it's coming from. And I'm going to suggest today that there's a common thread to many of these things, but I want to have a little closer look at some of the kinds of things that are amiss in our culture And in fact, I was a professor, and so maybe it's fair for me to point out that a number of these troubling things are coming from the professor. They are lessons that are being taught in the hallowed halls of academia and in higher education. And one of the main lessons, and one of the things that I think makes people feel ill at ease about the direction the culture is going, is this pervasive and overweening devaluing of human life. There's a professor here at the University of Texas, here I mean in the big state in which we now reside, named Eric Pianka. He's famous for suggesting at one point that 90% of the Earth's population should be eliminated, should be culled, in order to preserve the Earth. He at one point suggested that the Ebola virus would be a perfectly legitimate means by which to accomplish this, although he later kind of backed off on that. But he has gone on to advocate that we ought to confiscate the wealth of all families with two or more children as a way, again, of saving the Earth. Odd. Why is it so important to save the Earth, so important that we would kill people? Most people find that a little crazy, but there we have it from a zoology professor at the University of Texas. At Princeton University, we have Peter Singer emphasizing the idea that humans do not have any special or unique value in the scheme of things. In fact, he said that the life of a newborn baby is of less value than a full-grown pig or dog or chimpanzee. Well, why? Because the pig or dog can walk and the baby can't yet do so. It doesn't have the same capacities. That makes a number of us feel ill at ease. But why is this supposedly learned man asserting this with such confidence and rigor? At MIT, another professor, sometimes I get Steven Pinker and Peter Singer mixed up because their doctrines are so similar. He's actually said that infanticide, while not actually advocating it, he says it's completely understandable. Infanticide is the natural response of a young woman who instinctively understands that she's not prepared to care for a child yet, so she kills the firstborn or the secondborn in hopes that, or instinctively realizing that later on she will be better prepared to be a mother and therefore help the human race in that way. He says, Newsweek magazine writing about his work says, infanticide can no longer be considered abnormal. Instead, it is as normal as parenting instincts, sex drives, and self-defense. What's going on here? On abortion. This is Alexander Sanger, the grandson of Margaret Sanger, who founded the Planned Parenthood organization. He doesn't say that abortion is the lesser of two evils, as many defenders of it will say. He actually says it's a positive good. He says that nature does not let every human life form survive. Humanity uniquely and to its benefit can exercise some dominion over this process and maximize the chances for human life to survive and grow by killing some human life, presumably for the benefit of those who survive. Again, this seems not only counterintuitive, but absolutely crazy to lots of ordinary Americans, and they don't know what's underlying it, where this is coming from. And in fact, this sense of moral chaos in the realm of sexuality has been defended as really all you can expect. Michael Ruse and E.O. Wilson, two scientists and philosophers of science, say that ethics is actually an illusion. There's no objective standards of morality because ethics, as we understand it, is an illusion that's been fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate. So there's a physiological or genetic explanation for the illusion of ethical norms, but there are no real ethical norms. Now, all of this amounts to a radical change in our understanding of human nature. We're not capable of making ethical decisions. We have no free will. We are completely free to kill our own children. And ultimately, we have no more or less value than anything else in the living world, the animal kingdom or anything else. But then there's another strain of cultural dis-ease that has put a lot of people ill at ease about the direction of our culture, and it has to do with belief in God and the pervasive sense that we have lost any belief in a transcendent God, and that this sense or this loss is occurring in the church as much as anywhere else. You may know that every spring, there's a rabbi out in Los Angeles who preaches a sermon in his synagogue declaring that the Exodus never happened, that the Exodus account in the Hebrew Bible is not reliable. But there are similar strains of thought within Christian theology. A couple years ago, Jesus made the front cover of Newsweek magazine, of Time magazine, and I think U.S. News and World Report as well. And it wasn't because there was mass conversions to Christianity among the reporters and editors at these places. Instead, they were giving ink to this school of thought of which I'm sure you know, the Jesus Seminar, the group of scholars who have voted on different passages of the Bible to decide their historicity, and not surprisingly have come to the conclusion that great sections of the New Testament are not historically reliable, in particular all those that affirm any kind of miraculous deeds or events, including the resurrection of Jesus himself. Now, this was presented as a new school of thought, but of course it isn't really new. It goes back to the higher critical innovations in theology in the late 19th century, but it's something that's very pervasive, and this kind of thinking is pervasive at seminaries and is one of the reasons that that many students go to seminary and lose their faith. I'm sure that doesn't happen here. But you know the strain of thought that I'm talking about. Some of this has been popularized in books like The Da Vinci Code, which among its many other themes affirmed that the real historical Jesus was merely a human prophet who died in the first century, and that the Bible was substantially historically unreliable. But then we're also finding that this is a kind of covert atheism, I think, that's at work here, but we're also finding a very overt atheism in the form of this new atheism, this popular publishing phenomenon that kind of took the New York publishing houses by storm in 2006 and 2007. The most popular book in this genre was Richard Dawkins's The God Delusion, but others like Breaking the Spell, Letter to a Christian Nation, the books by Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris, a whole group of people arguing that science has disproven God. Now, there's nothing new in that, but what is new is the immense resonance that this message apparently has had with the book-buying public and how ready people are to accept this. So, and maybe not surprisingly, if there is no God, you have other professors saying that the universe is pointless and that there's no purpose to human existence. Here's Steven Weinberg from the University of Texas saying, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems utterly pointless." It's kind of a downer message. This is supposed to be a chapel service, but I think we've got to reckon with this. What's going on here? We have a different picture of God being conveyed. If he exists at all, he's not capable of doing miracles, and a very different conception of man. Now, where is all this coming from? Now, in one sense, you could blame it on the universities. It's coming from all these professors, Michael Ruse at Florida State, Richard Dawkins at Oxford, Daniel Dennett, the great new atheist philosopher at Tufts University, Peter Singer at Princeton, and on we go, Weinberg at Texas, Bianca at Texas. But that's in a way of, that's a fairly shallow analysis, because it really, all of these statements are an expression of a deeper thought form, a deeper way of thinking, what we might call a worldview. There's a proverb that says, "As a man thinketh, so shall he act," or "so is he in his heart," depending on the translation. That thought determines, our deepest thoughts end up determining what we say, what we advocate, and what we do. Okay? And so what I'm interested in is not where this is coming from in the sense of what universities have professors that are saying these kinds of things that are making us feel so ill at ease, but what is the underlying thought form that makes statements like this seem so credible, so plausible, and so persuasive to such a vast section of our population? Why is this way of thinking so popular, and what exactly is this way of thinking? Well, Steven Weinberg, I think, actually gives us the nicest clue here, because he's talking about the idea that the universe seems, the more it seems comprehensible, by reference to perhaps our materialistic scientific outlook, the more it seems utterly pointless. And that puts me in mind of actually, I think what he's actually revealing is a kind of worldview. A worldview that has very often been called materialism or scientific materialism, and because the view derives, presumably, from science itself. And here's a way of encapsulating the worldview in a way that I think you'll recognize the formalism here. From eternity past were the particles, and the particles became complex living stuff, and the living stuff became aware, and the living stuff eventually conceived of God. This is my friend Philip Johnson's way of encapsulating the materialistic world outlook. It believes that it answers a question that all worldviews must answer. What philosophers will refer to as the question of metaphysics or ontology, but which is sometimes referred to in more common parlance as the question of the prime reality. What is the thing from which everything else comes? That's the fundamental question that any philosophical system or worldview must answer. And the materialists answer that question by affirming that the fundamental thing from which all else comes is the particles, is matter and energy, the physical stuff of the universe in its smallest manifestation. And then they tell a story, essentially. There's a narrative, a great cosmic narrative of this materialistic worldview, and it's been supported by various scientific theories. And the idea is that the particles eventually arrange themselves to become more complex chemical compounds, which arrange themselves to eventually become life, which evolves and morphs and changes to become more complex life, which eventually, through that, which process eventually produces us, and then we conceive of the idea of God. But God is not a reality. God, like morality, is an illusion, one perhaps fobbed off on us by our genes. So in the materialistic worldview, you have matter at the beginning and God at the end of the process, but God only as a concept in the human mind, one which will die and rot when the human species dies and rots at the heat death of the universe. No wonder the universe seems pointless. Now, the theistic worldview, the biblical worldview, is exactly the opposite. It is God in the beginning who speaks the universe into existence. And, in fact, in the book of John, it says, "In the beginning was the Word," which is an expression of the idea that God's spirit, his mind, precedes the material realm, which he shapes and directs and creates throughout the history of the universe. So you have the very opposite. You have God at the beginning, matter second, whereas the materialistic worldview swaps the two and denies the reality of God. This is the central issue in our current cultural, some sociologists call it a culture war. It's really a conflict of visions. It's a conflict of ideas about fundamental reality. Now, the question, what I want to suggest is that all these different things that are putting people, making people feel ill at ease, are actually a manifestation of a deeper way of thinking. They are a manifestation of this materialistic way of thinking. And I want to make a little case for that and show the connection between this materialistic way of thinking and these things that the people are saying that make us all feel so like the wheels are coming off the culture. But before I do that, I want to ask another question in the same spirit of, as a man thinketh, so shall he act, or so is he. Let's ask another question. And by the way, this is a pictorial representation of the materialistic worldview. The circle behind me represents the physical universe. The thing on the rope represents a pendulum for the laws of nature. The guy standing next to it is a human being, obviously, who's being governed by the laws of nature. And all that exists is all the material stuff in the universe, and there is nothing beyond the universe. No God, no purpose, no transcendent standards of morality. That's the materialistic worldview. But the deeper question is, where does that come from? Why does that way of looking at things have so much sway in our culture? Why is that such a dominant way of thinking? And let's be clear, it is perhaps not a dominant way of thinking among ordinary pew-sitting Christians or even ordinary folk in the heartland, but it is certainly the dominant way of thinking in the universities, in the law schools, in the courts, and even in many of the seminaries. So why is that? What gives this way of thinking so much sway, so much power? Why is it so persuasive to so many people? Where does it ultimately come from? Well, I think, and this is something that we've looked at carefully at the Discovery Institute, I think the materialistic way of thinking is a natural outgrowth of the science of the 19th century. Not the science of the 21st century, but the science of the 19th century. In particular, the science of origins and biological origins even more particularly. Stephen Jay Gould perhaps gives us the best clue to this. He says that Darwin developed an evolutionary theory based on chance variation and natural selection, originally materialistic and basically atheistic version of evolution. You may know that evolution can mean many things, can mean simply change over time, but Gould is emphasizing here that Darwin's understanding of how that change over time took place was basically atheistic and materialistic. That is to say, God played no role in the change, and it was purely unguided and undirected and mindless. And that is standard, in fact, standard neo-Darwinism. Now, that starts to help make sense of some of these things that seem so troubling. Peter Singer, the man who said that human babies have no more value than pigs or dogs, he says his ethical system is just catching up with Darwin. He says that Darwin showed in the 19th century that we are simply animals. Humans had imagined that we were a separate part of creation, that there was some magical line between us and them. Darwin's theory undermined the foundations of that entire Western way of thinking about our species, said Peter Singer. And thus, there's no qualitative difference between humans and animals. There's no qualitative difference. And our ethics need to be based on that, says Singer. Okay? And that's why we deny, why Singer denies that there's any special value to a human being. That makes sense of, again, a clue here in this statement about abortion from Alexander Sanger. He says humans uniquely and can exercise some dominion over this process. What process is he talking about? The process by which nature doesn't let every form of life survive, the evolutionary process. Okay? Abortion is just something we can do to help the evolutionary process along. Michael Ruse, I concealed one of the parts of this quote. He starts by saying, morality is merely an adaptation put in place to further our reproductive ends. Why is there no morality? Well, because morality is just an illusion that's been programmed into us by our genes through the long evolutionary history of our planet. Is it starting to come into focus? These kind of crazy statements that reflect a materialistic understanding of human nature have a deeper root in a Darwinian creation story. Okay? And so, there was a cartoon in the Wall Street Journal just a little while ago that captured this, explaining where moral relativism comes from. A little hapless guy in front of a judge says, "Not guilty by reason of millions of years of evolutionary selection for aggressive behavior, Your Honor." Okay. I remember as a kid Flip Wilson saying, you know, the devil made me do it. Well, this guy's saying Darwin made me do it, or the Darwinian process made me do it, okay? This sounds humorous, but you may know that the first diminished responsibility plea in our jurisprudence goes back to Clarence Darrow and a Darwinian rationalization of a horrific crime. 1924, there are two young men, Leopold and Loeb, University of Chicago college students. They were taking philosophy courses on Nietzsche. Their professor explained how the standard Judeo-Christian morality was an illusion, and that people who were of the intellectual elite needed to repudiate that and exercise their will to power to show their freedom from bourgeois concepts of morality. The two young men took that to heart and went out and did motiveless crime. It was philosophically motivated. They killed a 12-year-old boy. They were convicted. There was no doubt about their guilt. And at the point of sentencing, Clarence Darrow, a year later to be famous in the Scopes trial, came out from the ACLU in New York to plead for clemency. And this is what he said. Is Dickie Loeb to blame because of the infinite forces that were at work at him before he was born? Is he to blame because his machine is imperfect? He went on to argue that nature is strong and we are all her victims, and that we are all the product of a long, undirected, mindless process of evolution. So sure, these two young men, they have a defective moral machinery, but it's not their fault. They were programmed to be that way by the evolutionary process. That was the first, we sometimes call it the insanity plea or the diminished responsibility plea. What was the root? It was, again, this Darwinian thought form or this materialistic conception of man, which is very closely and intimately connected. So, oh, and what about our new conception of God, or lack thereof, the loss of belief in God? That, too, has a Darwinian root. Richard Dawkins spells it out very clearly. He says that since the argument for design was always the strongest reason to believe in God, and since Darwin has shown that there is no design, only the illusion of design, belief in God is tantamount to a delusion. We haven't conclusively disproved it, but it's very, very, very improbable, he says. Why? Darwin has made belief in God unnecessary. There's a simpler, clearer, easier explanation for the appearance of design in nature, the undirected process of natural selection that can mimic the powers of a designing intelligence. And Dawkins then goes on to spell out basically this same materialistic thought form that I described a minute ago, the worldview. He says, creative intelligences being evolved necessarily arrive late in the universe and therefore cannot be responsible for designing it. God, in the sense defined, therefore, is a delusion, a pernicious delusion. Now, just a year or so ago, we had a very tragic report in our office of a heartbroken father who called us to tell about a young man who was, he'd come out of the military, his son, and had gone into higher ed. He was in college. His professor was urging him to read Dawkins. And the book was found with the suicide note under his bed. Young man had been a believer in God, did not know how to answer these arguments of Dawkins, and was so heartsick at the death of God that he killed himself. His name is Jesse Kilgore. It's a tragic story. We have this epidemic of teen suicide in this country, and I think it has something to do with this, as Steven Weinberg says, the pointlessness of the universe. Well, this is, in a sense, all the bad news. And what people are sensing is what I call the bad fruit of this way of thinking. You could think of it as, well, we've got the new atheism, we have the devaluation of human life, we have moral relativism, we have liberal theology, we have ineffective evangelism. Evangelism makes no sense, you know, for someone who holds this worldview that says there's no God. We have teen suicide and despair, and the question is, where is it coming from? And applying that proverb, I think we should be looking for a thought form. And the thought form has a name, it's materialism, but the deeper root of that thought form is, the deepest root, I think, is the creation story that makes the materialistic worldview make sense. And that is coming from Darwinism and other associated theories in the 19th century. One scholar has pointed out that Darwin told us where we came from. Marx told us where we were going. He had a secular eschatology, a vision of a wonderful future, also based on materialistic science. And Freud told us what to do about our guilt. And between the three, these great scientific prophets of the 19th century answered all the basic worldview questions that heretofore Judeo-Christian Bible had answered. Okay, that's the bad news. And that is the introduction to my talk. Now the good news. There's an answer to this. This way of thinking was based, and by the way, the conclusion of the talk will not be as long as the introduction. This thought form of scientific materialism was based on the bad science of the 19th century. But the good science of the 21st century, what we know now, undermines this Darwinian, the Darwinian basis of this whole way of thinking. And I want to just give you a little tiny tease on some of the things that we'll be talking about in the conference. that will, yes, reinforce why this issue matters, but also show why the intellectual initiative in this great discussion about design or no design, about materialism and theism at the worldview level, is now, I think, being decisively shifted because of new developments in science. Okay. What is the central claim of Darwin? It's not just that things change, as I said before. It's the idea that the appearance of design in living organisms has resulted from a purely undirected natural process, most importantly, natural selection acting on random variations. Now, that idea is reinforced in all the modern neo-Darwinists as much as it was an idea in Darwin's own Origin of Species. Richard Dawkins, for example, said that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. That's what the theory of intelligent design is taking on. We're not concerned about whether evolution in the sense of change over time is a reality. Things change over time. Yes, they do. Okay, big deal. The question is, do they change in a purely undirected, mindless way, in the way as the Darwinists affirm? That's what we're challenging. And so the theory of intelligent design is the idea that there are key features of living systems, of living organisms, that can be best explained by the activity of an actual designing intelligence, not an undirected natural process like natural selection. In other words, we're saying that things look designed, biological systems look designed, because they really were designed. What a concept, okay? Couple signs of design. We're gonna give you a lot of exciting evidence if you're going to be attending the conference. But just a couple of things to whet your appetite. Many of you may have already encountered my colleague Michael Behe's wonderful book, Darwin's Black Box. And he has made famous these incredible miniature machines and circuits that work inside cells. There are little tiny turbines. There are sliding clamps. There are what are called signal transduction circuits. And this is one particular machine that he's made very famous. It's called the bacterial flagellar motor. It's got 30 protein parts that all work together to create a rotary engine in the cell wall of a bacterium. And this rotary engine has O-rings and bushings and a drive shaft and a U-joint and a hook-like and a propeller that functions just like a propeller in an outboard motor. Rotates at 100,000 RPM in some systems, can change directions on a quarter of a turn, and the whole system is hardwired into a signal transduction circuit. Behe makes a fascinating argument about why natural selection couldn't produce this. People have claimed to have refuted him, and we will be quite prepared to show that you can refute the refuters. Okay, so come hear more about this exciting argument, but I think if you're just looking at this at even intuitive level, you'll say, wow, that's kind of impressive. That's like high tech in low life. That's what we got, bacterium rotary engines. You don't usually put those two concepts together. But even the simplest forms of life have incredibly complex machinery in them. Here's another machine. This is working inside you right now. It's called an ATP synthase. It's an energy generating turbine. It runs on the same basic design logic as a hydroelectric dam. Instead of the rotor being turned by a flow of water, it's turned by a flow of ions, and it creates a torque on this stalk, creates an interesting conformational change in these proteins, creating a very specifically shaped pocket in which two other molecules can fit exactly and form a bond and create a little battery pack called ATP, which provides all the energy needs for your cells. These little machines are working in you right now as we speak. And you're not low life, okay? So now, even more fundamental than all this machinery, at least I think, is the information, the digital code stored in the DNA molecule that is responsible for directing the cell's protein-producing machinery to build this other machinery. It's a fascinating process. It's something like what goes on up at the Boeing plant in Seattle, where I live, where you have engineers who design a part in the computer. Their design is literally codified in digital code. It's then translated into another form of code that can be read by the manufacturing center, which then takes that information and uses it to, for example, put the rivets in exactly the right place as the airplane wing is being built. Information directing manufacturing. That's what's going on inside the cell. I argue in a new book that I just written called Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, that the information in DNA is powerful evidence for a prior designing intelligence. Bill Gates says human DNA is like a computer program, but far more advanced than any we've ever written. We know that programs require programmers. We know that information generally, whether we're talking about a hieroglyphic inscription, a section of text in a book, or a newspaper headline, or information embedded in a radio signal, information always comes from an intelligent source. So the discovery of digital code, of information in a digital format inside the cell, is powerful evidence of a prior designing intelligence. Incredible new discoveries. By the way, does Richard Dawkins address this argument in his book, The God Delusion? He does not. I say we have the intellectual initiative, and we'll come good on that in the conference. So in closing, I just want to bring this back. We are in a chapel service, and as I mentioned, I am, like you, a Christian. I think one of the most incredible things about modern science is not that it supports this materialistic worldview. If you look at science, the important discoveries of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, which we will be discussing in the conference, I think instead you see evidence that supports the existence of a designing intelligence and which affirms some of the key attributes of the Creator, just as St. Paul said 2 centuries ago. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. Being understood, notice what he says, not from Scripture, being understood from what has been made. Obviously, you can learn about God's qualities from Scripture too, but he's affirming that nature itself is bearing witness to the reality of God. And that, I think, is the fundamental issue in our culture today. The materialistic worldview denies the reality of God, and it does so because of the presumed truth of the Darwinian creation story and other associated materialistic theories of origins. But the reality of God, I think, is powerfully supported by new developments in science. Scientific theories like the theory of intelligent design, developments in cosmology as well, that I think have theistic implications that point to the reality of a designing mind and ultimately to a transcendent creator. So we'll be talking about this in the conference. I hope you'll see that this is a hugely consequential issue, because science today, in this debate about origins, is addressing this fundamental question, the prime reality question, and with it, the question of the reality of God. And so I'll just close by quoting this passage, because I think it's in a sense, I'm not a preacher, but I'm going to exhort, okay? You all have a role in this great intellectual issue of our day as well, because this is an issue that every person faces in deciding their own worldview, and you're going to encounter people from your role as pastors who are going to have questions about this fundamental issue of the nature of ultimate reality. And Paul says we can't be neutral about that. He says, in fact, we have to demolish arguments, I'm using the NIV, and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and take captive every thought and make it subject to Christ. This materialistic thought form is nothing if not a pretension that has set itself up against the knowledge of God, and it's based on certain scientific arguments that each of us need to acquaint ourselves with so that we are in a position to follow St. Paul's mandate here. Thank you very much.